Most of what we consider to be common knowledge about spiders is more common and less knowledge. Today, we'll learn the truth about these eight-legged creatures that freak so many humans out. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis will be here. We'll step outside the insect world to take an in-depth look at spiders. We'll talk about spider facts, myths, and legends. We'll find out why we erroneously blame spiders for so many of our problems and why we should tolerate these creepy companions. Horticulturist Richard Duran will also be here to answer your questions. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and we're going to start not with plants, but with spiders. Spiders are everywhere this time of year. They invade our warm houses. They dangle from large artificial webs lying in wait for trick-or-treaters. We all encounter spiders all the time, but most of what we know about them is wrong. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis is here today to explode some spider myths. Hello, Donald.
Hello, Charity. Good to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And we love to talk about spiders in our culture. I think that they are an arachnid that really captures our imagination.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think for one thing, we have an innate fear of them, and we sort of carry that over into our conversations to talk about them. But people love to talk about spiders for either one of the two reasons. Number one is we're just flat out afraid of them and assume that all spiders are out to suck our blood and to kill us. Or we recognize that all spiders are predators. They are beneficial. And in the landscape and garden, they are good for us. It's good to have spiders out there where they can feed on other insects and help control pest populations.
Well, let's talk about some of the myths. And you mentioned we have an innate fear of spiders. And that, I would guess, is because there are poisonous spiders in the world. It kind of makes sense for humans to be afraid of spiders, right?
I think so. But the number of dangerous spiders in the world is very, very low. And maybe at a time in our evolutionary history, there were more of them that we had to fear and be aware of. But for the average Iowan, the number of dangerous spiders that you're going to encounter is very, very low. And in fact, most of us can live our entire lives in Iowa and never see a dangerous spider. Now, this gets into some pretty specific terminology that probably isn't terribly important, but I prefer to use the word dangerous for those spiders that are going to have a potential to harm us, whereas the public tends to refer to dangerous spiders as poisonous, which isn't really quite accurate because spiders don't poison us, but spiders do have venom. So spiders are venomous, and the venom is for use of subduing the prey that they capture and eat. So venom, as the same proteins that are in wasp and bee stings and so forth, can have an effect on us, but it's not poison in the normal sense of the word, if that makes any sense at all.
All right. So dangerous spiders is the terminology we will stick with. A lot of people talk about having spider bites. In fact, we blame a lot of skin problems that we have on spiders, don't we?
I think after 37 years of answering the telephone and talking to people about the pests that they may have in their house and the conditions that they may experience, the phrase spider bite is a euphemism. That is, it's what we say when we don't know what to actually say. Spider bite is a euphemism for I have a skin irritation, but I don't know what caused it. I think spider bites are incredibly rare, but that's not the experience you get when you talk to people who assume that every unexplained skin irritation was a spider came up at night and bite them or whatever. Unless you see a spider in the act of inserting its fangs into your skin, there's no reason to believe that whatever red marks you have on your skin are a spider bite. Now, people make the assumption, oh, if I see two little punctures close together, that means it was a spider bite, right? Well, no. You get a double reaction from lots of things and not just from spider bites. But that one at least has a grain of truth about it because spiders do have two fangs. But most of our spiders, the punctures would be so close together that you wouldn't notice it as two. So, yes, spider bite is one of those terms that everybody uses. I think most of us are wrong when we say spider bite. Certainly it can happen, but I don't think it happens to the extent that people believe.
That takes away a lot of security in some ways, because now all those little bumps, I have no idea what they were.
That's right. They're still unknown. But the good news about calling them unknown skin irritations is that the spiders can go on about their business of eating insects and doing us a benefit without us having to declare all-out war on spiders. There's this effort to eliminate spiders from our environment, which isn't healthy for them or for us.
Now, there's another myth that gets passed around, and I think kids love to share this one with each other, and that is that we swallow an average of 7 to 8 spiders every year.
Without
knowing it.
Without knowing it. What a great myth, and what a great way to gross out your friends and neighbors is to say, oh, yeah, I ate my share of spiders last night. Totally without any basis in fact. We can't find any evidence that other than just the repeated rumor, internet rumor that we are all swallowing spiders at night. In fact, it's even hard to believe it would happen. For one, if you're sleeping with your mouth open, you're making a lot of noise and you're breathing through your mouth, and that alone would scare a spider away. It would deter a spider from crawling in. If there were a spider in your mouth, don't you think you would wake up? So it doesn't even seem logical when you stop and ask, oh, really? And that's what we should do with more of these stories and myths that we hear. If we would just stop and for one brief second say, oh, really? Then you would think about all these reasons why that can't be true. And swallowing spiders at night is one of the huge myths that has no basis in fact as far as we can tell.
All right, so we're not swallowing spiders in our sleep. That's good to know.
And they're not biting us in our sleep, so what's the big deal?
But we do find a lot of spiders in our homes. What makes our homes so attractive to spiders?
Well, part of it is it's a good shelter. If you have built a weather-tight structure where you're going to stay warm and dry and where the wind's not going to blow and tear your web apart, it's a great place to live and to have that shelter. Furthermore, and this is one that I really have trouble figuring out, is there must be an adequate food supply. That all those spider webs I see behind my water heater in the basement, what are they eating? They have to be eating something. They have to be eating small insects, maybe ants or fruit flies or something. But it certainly doesn't seem like there's a big supply of food in my house for those spiders to live on. But that's the other thing they have to have. You have to have shelter. You have to have food. And when we give any critter those two requirements of life, they'll set up housekeeping and stay as long as they can.
So the spiders that are living behind your water heater are probably taking care of other insects that you don't necessarily want to see crawling around your house either?
Exactly. Probably a few ants, a few gnats, whatever else is in there. But there doesn't seem to be a lot for them to eat, especially those what we call the long-bodied cellar spiders are the ones that are frequently making the very loose, irregular webs between the joists in your unfinished basement. And I don't know what they eat when they're up there, but there are those webs. And, of course, spiders make webs for lots of reasons. But in that case, the spider webs are for catching food.
You mentioned that they're beneficial to have in the garden. Are there problems that have been created because we've been so bent on getting rid of spiders?
I can't think of anything that specifically relates to spiders. Of course, we're so interested in sanitizing the world around us that we eliminate weeds and we use more insecticides to get rid of harmful insects than we probably should in some situations. So spiders are part of that. We need that biodiversity out there, and spiders are certainly a piece of that. But as far as conscious attempts to eliminate spiders changing the ecosystem, not that I can think of.
Is that because spiders are so very hard to get rid of?
Yes. Okay. For one thing, we don't have good arachnocides. We use insecticides to kill spiders, but as every grade school kid knows, the eight legs, the two body sections make spiders not insects, and the insecticides that do get picked up and work fairly well on insects don't always work as well against spiders, in part because it's harder to get the insecticide into a spider than it is to get it into an insect because of the way they live and so forth. But yes, spiders are difficult to control, and we spend a lot of time and effort doing it.
We do have a couple of dangerous spiders that show up in Iowa from time to time. And of course, when they do, those stories get spread far and wide when somebody encounters a brown recluse spider, for example. What should we be aware of if we're going to live and tolerate spiders better than we have? What do we need to do to make sure that we are safe?
There are lots of good pictures of the brown recluse spider on the internet. And the thing to think about when you look at the brown recluse spider is it's a fragile looking spider. And they have this little tiny body and these long thread-like legs. It's not beefy spider like a wolf spider. It's not got big legs like a jumping spider. They have these little fragile thread-like legs. The other thing is to think about the name. What does it mean if you're called a recluse? It means you don't come out in the open very often. So you're probably going to have to go looking for brown recluse spiders as opposed to them coming out looking for you. So knowing what they look like is part of it, recognizing that tan coloration, recognizing the configuration of the legs compared to the body and so forth, and knowing that they're going to be in the darkest, quietest, hardest to reach places, making these a loose tangle of webs. So one of the things we do in general spider control is to just suck up with the vacuum cleaner spiders, webs, and eggs as we find them. And that's good management for all spiders, including the brown recluse.
There has been this video circulating on the internet. I don't know if you've seen it lately, Donald, but the world's largest spider is the size of a puppy is the title of the video.
It's amazing what you can do with Photoshop. back in the Iraq War, there are these pictures of soldiers holding up by the front legs a camel spider that's about half the size of a human. Photoshop does amazing things. And, of course, unless they live in the water, all exoskeleton animals like insects and spiders can't achieve those sizes. So great myths abound.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment to answer your questions. We'll answer questions about arachnids, insects, or, of course, the plants in your life. Richard Duran will be joining the conversation in just a moment with me right now. Donald Lewis, Iowa State University Extension entomologist. You can call us at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. Also joining us now, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Duran. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
Welcome back. We missed you last week, but we did spend a lot of time talking about squash bugs.
I heard that, yes.
So we'll try to move on to other subjects this week. You can give us a call if you have questions about insects, arachnids, or the plants in your life. 866-780-9100. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Phoebe is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Phoebe.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I have a question about a lilac bush in my yard. Yesterday, I noticed that it was budding out on about half of the shrub. Also, it had two flowers bloomed on the shrub, but the flower did not look like a lilac. It looked more like a cornflower.
Well,
but it smelled like a lilac also.
Yeah. Now, the buds on lilacs are quite large, so they should be there right now. Now, as far as some of the flowers, I have a few flowers on one of my lilacs. And I think what happened was we had all that rain in June, and then we had a dry July, and I think the shrubs went kind of semi-dormant.
Okay.
And then with all the rain in basically August and September, that encouraged them to break bud and to form some flowers. So I'm not worried about that. I think it's basically the weather. So I think it should be okay. Maybe a smaller number of flowers next spring, but it should be okay.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, Phoebe, thank you so much for your call. And here's an email question from Laura. Is it too late to plant tulips, crocus, and other spring blooming bulbs?
Absolutely not. October is the best time. You can do it as late as late November if the weather permits, but sometimes it doesn't in Iowa. So you want to get them in typically in October. I've done it in late November, and I froze my fingers. So you don't really want to do that if you can avoid it.
This weekend would be the perfect
yes,
time.
This weekend would be great.
The ground should be soft, too, because
yes.
of all the rain.
Right.
I have about 200 left to get in.
Ah.
So.
More than me.
All right. I have a plan for the weekend myself. All right. This is from Tim. Does anyone know why, and he says, I think they are, garden spiders create large and elaborate webs overnight. Then they disappear next morning. I've been curious about this for a while.
Well, the garden spider is one of our common garden spiders and our common spiders in Iowa. We see them in the fall of the year, and they make what you would think of as a typical spider web. If you just were asked to draw what a spider web looks like, you would make these concentric circles and radiating lines, and that's the type of web that that kind of spider makes. We often see them along the roadsides in the fall of the year where it's suspended between two pieces of grass, and then it's covered with dew, and then in the morning light, they often look quite pretty and artistic. Spiders spend a lot of time, energy, and resources spinning silk from the spinnerets on their abdomen, and that's a protein that they have put out into the environment for a purpose. But in order to save energy and save resources, they will recycle the web by eating it. So spider webs will appear. They will be recycled by some spiders that eat part of that webbing, or when the spider web gets covered with dust so it's no longer sticky and functional, they'll abandon it and move to another area. So a couple of things happen with spider webs, but one is the spiders will ingest it and recycle it.
All right. That's good to know. I know that they also get stuck to my face when I walk outside early in the morning and duck
yep.
under branches. That's another thing that they do.
Gossamer is a fact of life in Iowa, especially in the fall of the year.
All right. Marcia is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Marcia.
How you doing today?
Good. And you have a joke for us?
Yes, I do. I had some questions about bulbs. Somebody said to use chicken wire, but I don't know how to do it. But my humor to offer you this morning is, what's the difference between men and women? Men talk about how big the fish was, and women talk about how big the spider was. You know how it is, gals. Sometimes you find one in the bathtub, it gets up on its hind legs and growls at you.
That's right. And sometimes they seem the size of a dinner plate, you know. They just seem that large. Well, that's pretty good. I think we can use that in extension in the future.
All right. So, okay. And Marcia, what was your question about bulbs?
Someone told me to use chicken wire to help protect them from the critters that tend to eat them up in the ground. I have a bunch to put out, and I'm not exactly sure how to approach it with chicken wire.
I don't think that should be a big problem, actually. What you might want to do is cover the area once you plant them with chicken wire or hardware cloth so those squirrels can't dig them up, and then remove that in the spring. Moles, for example, will not eat them, so really the threat is not that great.
Okay, so you can just lay it on top and then pick it up in the springtime.
Right.
There was such a great walnut crop in my yard this year that I think, hey, the squirrels will just eat walnuts. They won't bother the bulbs. Do you think I'm right?
No.
I think you're wishful thinking.
They bury the walnuts for later on. So.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Norma is on the line. And Carol, hi, Norma.
Hi. I have a question about, I was wondering what are these, I call them worms, that they come in large amounts and they come into buildings and they come in the basement They're kind of hard. If you step on them, they crunch.
And when you pick one up or when they die, they coil into a spiral?
Yes.
Yeah. Those are millipedes.
Oh.
Millipedes are in a class of their own, and millipedes have four legs on each ring of the body. So when one of them's coiled up in the spiral, you can pick it up and count the rings and multiply by four, and you'll know how many legs they have. Millipedes are beneficial because they are scavengers that feed on decaying organic matter in damp locations. But some years we just get so many of them out there under the mulch, under the dead grass, in the cracks of the retaining wall, under the plant debris in the roadside ditches, under the plant debris in the CRP fields, and they get a wanderlust and they take off on warm, moist nights crawling with nowhere to go and all night to get there. And so they wander into the house by accident where it's so dry they coil up and die within a matter of hours because there's no wet hiding place for them. So millipedes are annoying. You often get anywhere from dozens to hundreds to thousands in your house. We try to keep them out the best we can by sealing up cracks and gaps, but it's a temporary annoyance that we try to tolerate because we recognize millipedes are beneficial to the ecosystem.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Norma. And this one is from Mac in West Union. He says, I picked up a bit of info somewhere that some spiders love cockroach eggs and will actively hunt for them. Ever since then, I've tolerated spiders as my primary line of defense. True or false?
Partly true.
Okay.
There are spiders that are cockroach predators. Huntsman spider is one that is a name that comes to mind. And these are fairly large spiders found more in tropical areas, southern Florida, than they would be up here in Iowa. But the huntsman spider is like our wolf spider in that it chases, it pursues its prey and eats cockroaches at night. I think they feed on the cockroaches themselves more than the cockroach eggs. So one of the theoretical things you could do if you lived in the tropics is tolerate spiders in your house as a cockroach control. I don't think it's going to work very well for us up this far north, but in the tropics, that might be a suitable alternative to insecticides in the house. Oh, but that requires having large spiders in your house instead. So you got to consider that trade-off pretty closely, don't you?
All right. But if tolerating the spiders has worked well so far, there's no reason to stop, right?
Right. As long as they are a wolf spider or one of those and not the brown recluse spider. Now, the brown recluse spider, recall, builds those loose webs in the undisturbed locations. Cockroaches are not likely to climb up into a brown recluse web and get caught. So they're going to be less effective at controlling cockroaches and active insects like that than would be these other spiders that are specialists for that.
You're listening to Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. You can join the conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist and Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. So you can also ask your insect and arachnid questions today as well. The number again is 866-780-9100. RJ is on the line in Urbandale. Hi, RJ.
Hi there, everybody. I found a black spider with an white hourglass on its belly. Is that something of concern? And also, what was the other poisonous spider you were talking about other than the brown recluse that's in Iowa?
Oh, we never got around to naming it. We kind of ran out of our time before we got there. There are several widow spiders. The one that gets all the attention is the southern black widow, which is a shiny patent leather black spider with a large marble-sized bulbous abdomen, and on the underside of that is a red hourglass. There are other widow spiders, including the northern widow and a few others, that don't really fit that pattern, and it's possible what you have is one of these northern widows where the hourglass has turned a little less reddish orange and more toward the white. So that it That's a likely guess, and we can look up widow spiders and get lots and lots of pictures of the southern black widow, fewer pictures of the northern widow.
Can I have concern for that? Should I have been worried about that?
Even the black widow is not a terrible concern for us in that if it bites you, it's more like a bee sting.
And yep.
Being bitten is unlikely. It's not going to be fatal to most people. So we tend to over-dramatize how dangerous that spider might really be. The farther north we get, the less likely they are to be a problem for us. But we don't want to take our chances and press our luck. So we try not to hold them against tender skin too often.
Hey, quick question for Richard. Hey, what should we put down on our lawn right now? I got weeds and different things. So is there anything I should put down for the fall?
Well, you can still fertilize. You can do that basically between now and early November. You can also put on a broadleaf herbicide at this point, and you can do that until early November too.
Okay, can I mix them together or put them at the same time or
you,
what?
You can buy a combination product, which is going to be a granular product.
Uh-huh.
It's going to be a fertilizer and a broadleaf herbicide. You can buy one of those and apply it in combination. Yes.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thanks a lot for your call, RJ. And one more spider question before we move on to some other things. And, of course, we can go back to spiders if we need to. But if this puppy-sized spider from the Amazon rainforest turns out to be a hoax, this is from Mary. I would like to know, what is the largest spider and how large is it without Photoshop?
Well, I may have to backpedal slightly on this because while you were taking your break, I did Google.
You looked at it, all right.
I picked up puppy the size or spider the size of a puppy. And it turns out it's the giant bird-eating spider, which we also call the bird-eating tarantula. And they refer to it as a whopping 6-ounce spider. 6 ounces doesn't sound like much of a puppy to me. Body the size of your fist. So, yes, that giant bird-eating tarantula does hold the record, according to the websites I was looking at, as the largest spider.
The puppy comparison may be a bit of an exaggeration, though, you're saying.
Why didn't they say the size of a baby chihuahua? You know? To call it a puppy's, I was picturing my Labrador puppy.
Right. Maybe a kitten.
Yeah,
size.
Maybe a baby kitten would have been a better explanation.
All right. So is that the largest spider that we do know about?
I think so.
All right.
Yep. That bird-eating tarantula is one that has been around for a long time and gets a lot of notoriety. Frequently, you can buy those in pet stores. They make pretty good pets. You can keep them inside. Calling them bird-eating is to dramatize what they might eat if they could catch it. More likely, they're going to eat large insects and maybe some very small mammals. But if presented with a bird, it's a spider that could handle it if it needed to.
All right. So you wouldn't have to feed it birds if you tried to keep one as a pet.
No, that's right. You could probably feed it crickets like everything else.
Okay, good. I don't want one. just on the record in case you're thinking about holiday gifts.
Yeah, no. Especially for Halloween. Wouldn't a pet spider be kind of a fun thing to have?
Sure. Okay, Jim's on the line next in Waterloo. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I have a rose bush that I purchased to replace a rose bush that died over the last winter with winter kill.
Mm-hmm.
It's doing beautifully. It's almost the size of a 55-gallon drum. It's wide. It's tall. Mm-hmm. But I only see 2 blooms on it all summer long.
Okay.
Should I be thinking about replacing that again for next year?
Well, give it one more shot, one more year. And so what I would do is maybe in mid-November, take some soil from the garden and place that around the base of the rose, covering the bottom, let's say, 8 to 10 inches of the rose canes. Leave that in place until spring. Remove that and then prune out the dead wood next spring and see what it does. And if it doesn't bloom well next year, I would say remove it.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Jim, thanks a lot for your call. And Ralph is up next in Grinnell. Hi, Ralph.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
I sell walnut meats in Iowa City at the farmer's market, and different people ask me, what's the best way to dry the nuts? I said, you got to wash them off good and put them on a wire rack and let them sit for a couple of weeks. Do you guys concur?
I would say so, yes.
This is after you've got the husks off
right,
of them.
Right,
yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Power wash the husk off, and And they like today, nothing's going to dry, right?
No,
not very well.
You know,
power washing the husk off is great, though, because then your hands don't smell for the rest of time.
And that's so much easier and high tech than what Dad used to do. We would spread the walnuts on the driveway and drive the car back and forth over them. That's how we got the husks released, was we just drove the car over them. Interesting.
The traditional method. All right, Ralph, thanks a lot for your call. And here's a question from Amy. She said, I have several gardens that are covered in wood mulch, and the mulch has probably been there for several seasons. Some of it's starting to mold.
Mm-hmm.
So I need to remove the mulch, and I'm wondering if I should do that this fall or if I can wait until spring.
I wouldn't remove it.
Okay.
Those molds are not going to affect the plants themselves. They're just living on the decaying organic matter. I would just add a fresh layer next spring.
All right. That's good, because removing mulch is a terrible, terrible job.
No, I wouldn't do
hard
that.
To pick it up. And, of course, with 10 to 14 inches of rain in August this year, there's a lot more moisture in that mulch than there would be at this time normally. So a little fluffing, a little stirring, a little fresh on top, and you're good to go.
Although you could also, I don't know, maybe you could get a CrossFit team to come out and help you with that.
Maybe.
An alternate workout for the fall.
You have
trying to think outside the box.
You have access to a CrossFit team?
I'm going to take a break here. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. You can join our conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, horticulturist Richard Duran and entomologist Donald Lewis, both from Iowa State University Extension. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and you are welcome to join our conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Duran and Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. And John is on the line next in Waterloo. Hi, John.
Good morning. I don't know if I've not been observant in the past, but I noticed, are they called woolly bears, those little caterpillars that have with the black on both ends and red band in the middle?
Yep, banded woolly bear.
And I don't know, what they make, and or is there a larger population this year? Or
yes.
I have been seeing a lot of them, too.
And you drive down the highway, and you'll see one or two per mile crossing the road. One of the great disappointments of my life is there is no good humorous answer to the question, why did the woolly bear cross the road? But that's where we always see them crossing the road.
I see them crossing in opposite directions. You know, I'll see one going one way and another going the other way. And I think, hey, just save yourself the danger.
The grass is always greener on the other side of the road. So they, I think they crossed the road to prove to the raccoon that it could be done. But woolly bears are grass feeders. They're a caterpillar that have lived out there in the grass alongside the road for the last 4 to 6 weeks. The adult stage is a fairly attractive yellowish-white moth that pretty much goes unnoticed. Banded woolly bear is one of about 6 different kinds of woolly bears we have here in the upper Midwest. But when you say woolly bear to somebody, they think of the banded woolly bear. And before Charity asks the question, no, the size of the bands do not predict the severity of the winter. The amount of black on the end of a reddish-brown woolly bear's body is an indication of how much moisture was in the environment when it was feeding and growing. So it is a variable. There's more or less black, but it has nothing to do with what's coming. It tells us what already happened.
Okay. And what do they turn into?
They turn into a yellowish-white moth, but not until next year. And the banded woolly bear is an interesting one in oftentimes most of our caterpillars will make their cocoon now, and they will spend the winter in the cocoon stage and then turn into a moth next year. The banded woolly bear stays as a caterpillar through the winter. And you can open up your wood pile in the winter, and there's a banded woolly bear sort of coiled up, hibernating. Then they make their cocoon in the springtime.
All right, and it must have just been a perfect year for them.
Somehow, with all that rain in August and good moisture through the first half of the year, I mean, we had some dry in June and July, but it wasn't too dry, apparently. Yes, the banded woolly bears have made a great comeback this year.
All right, next up, let's go to Matt on the line in Mason City. Hi, Matt.
Hey, I had a quick question. I do cable. I'm very, very familiar with spiders. I'm in crawl spaces and attics and behind people's TVs that they never move. And recently I've seen a couple people in Iowa here are smart enough to go to Arizona in the winter, and they come back with these weird rocks that they put up in their drop ceiling. I'm just wondering, are these effective for repelling spiders, or what are they called, or is it just some kind of hoax they got sold on?
Wow, it's great to come on the radio on Friday and hear about things I had never heard about before. Weird rocks from Arizona that are supposed to eliminate spiders.
They kind of look like pumice, and I've had this happen at least 6 different times with different folks that head south for the winter, and they come back with these rocks, and when I go to hook up their TV, honestly, no spider webs, so I don't know if this is just some kind of weird off thing or...
Well, my guess is they swept up the spider webs before they put the rocks in. So I've never heard of a rock from Arizona, but you know, we're going to Google this when we get a chance as well.
I'm already trying. I'm not getting anything yet.
Yeah. Of course, when you talk about an object, a round object that you put down for spider and mouse and cricket control, the one that comes to mind is hedge apples, that people who live in the South have an abundant supply of hedge apples growing outside on the Osage orange trees. Those of us who live this far north have to go to the grocery store and buy them for $1.50 a piece to put them out on the hope that it will keep bugs away from our house. Doesn't do it. It's not going to work as a repellent, just putting them around. So lots of ideas of things that will miraculously...
And they're an invasive species, so careful.
That's right, the Osage orange is. Lots of rumors and beliefs in what will work, and it must work for some people some of the time, but no evidence of that. But now I have to look up Arizona pumice.
All right,
spider control.
Let us know what you find, and I'm thinking about opening up a stand, actually. I thought we've got rocks here I could sell. All right, Matt, thank you so much for your call. Next up, Barbara's on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Barbara.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
My daughter is a student at Iowa State and lives in a ground floor apartment, and she believes she has hobo spiders in her room, and she's quite terrified because she's looked them up and has seen some nasty necrotic-looking bites.
Right.
Is this something to be worried about in Iowa? And is it possible?
No. The hobo spider by that name probably doesn't exist here, and it looks, what you see on the internet looks exactly like yellow sack spider, S-A-C, yellow sack spider, which we all have in our houses. We all see that at the junction between the wall and the ceiling, and there they just sort of sit and wait. Sack spiders,
I know what you're talking about.
Yep,
yes.
Sack spiders are not a dangerous spider. And the rumors about hobo spider are under review and are likely to change. But we've got a whole generation that believe there's something called the hobo spider that's out to bite them and kill them. And it's now under review that it may not even be a problem that it originally was assumed to be.
Okay. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Barbara. Next up, let's go to Mark and Marion. Hi, Mark. Mark, are you there? All right, I don't have Mark, so let's try Roger in Duncombe. Hello, Roger.
How are you today, Charity?
Good. What's your question?
Well, I have a thing to share with you about the spiders. If you didn't see it last week, there was an article both on the web and in the AP about a family down in a St. Louis suburb that bought a house that they paid nearly $500,000 for, and it was totally infested with brown recluse. They had to sue the people that sold it to them. They got a $472,000 judgment against them. A professor from Kansas University, who's supposedly the leading expert in brown recluse in the United States, said there were at least 4,000 of those spiders in the house.
Ugh.
And they ended up, they tried to have it fumigated twice and had no success, and that's when they sued The mortgage company had another extermination company come. They supposedly wrapped the house in plastic tarps and then fumigated it. And hopefully that will get rid of them. It was supposed to kill the spiders, the eggs, and everything. But I couldn't imagine 4,000 spiders in your house. Woo-hoo! Gives you the whim-whams. Yeah. A question about a maple tree, and I'd like to ask Dr. Duran this. It happened. Nature provided a sapling maple for me, and it's now going on, I believe it's 3 years old. It's approximately 3 inches trunk at the base, and it's about, I would say, 16 to 18 feet high. Should I move it now, because I don't want it where it is, or should I wait until spring?
Well, it's going to be hard to move. That's a pretty big tree, but if I was going to do that, I would do it definitely early in the spring before it begins to leaf out. And you might want to consider trying to get a tree spade to move it.
Oh, that's exactly what I intend
to
do.
Okay, okay.
Yeah. Now, how could I prune the, because the branches that, you know, go fairly low to the ground, could I prune those yet this fall?
You could. Now, I would be a little bit conservative on that because for the tree to recover, it needs as many leaves as possible next spring and summer. So the more branches you take off, the fewer the leaves next spring and summer. So prune what you have to, but leave the rest.
All right. Thank you so much for your call. And let's go next to David in Minnesota. Hi, David.
Hi. How are you guys?
Good. What's your question?
Well, I had a question about this bug that is in my basement, and I've always heard it called a silverfish. It's kind of whitish, and it's got like 1,000 legs on it, and it's wicked fast, and they're horrible looking. How do you stop them, or why? There's not too many, but
yeah, creepy looking is what they are.
Silverfish,
in spite of its name, is an insect which only has 6 legs. And what you just described is a 1 1/4 inch arthropod that has 30 legs.
Yeah.
Therefore, it can't be an insect, but it's called the house centipede. And house centipedes have about 30 legs on 15 rings of the body. They are beneficial because they are eating spiders and other insects out of the quiet, undisturbed locations of your house. But they are creepy, and people swat at them with the newspaper or the slipper or whatever is handy. They're harmless. They're not going to hurt you, but they are terribly annoying. The problem with controlling them is they live in the hardest-to-reach spots in your house, behind the stuff stored in the basement, behind and under the furnace, behind and under the washing machine. They are hard to reach to control, but more vacuum cleaning of edges and storage areas would help, and swat them as you see them, and try to live and let live because they are beneficial.
Yeah, thank you very much.
House centipede.
All right.
We've had both centipedes and millipedes today. It's
nice.
A good day.
We're covering all the ground. Well, here's another one. Chris from Twitter says, box elders are everywhere. How might one drive them away?
Oh, use lots of soapy water, but that's going to be your hobby, to stand outside and spray them as they appear. Garden insecticides like bifenthrin will kill them slowly on the side of your house and in the yard next to your house. Most of us have a tolerable number, but yes, it's just incredible how every once in a while someone will get tens of thousands of them on the side of their house on these warm October days. You can't get rid of them. You're going to have to come to some sort of peace with them, either by killing the ones you can with soapy water, using an insecticide spray, vacuuming them off the side of the house, vacuum the ones that get inside. But is it 60 or 80 years of putting up with box elder bugs in our houses, we're still no closer to a silver bullet control.
And this will pass, right?
Eventually. It may be next spring if you get a lot of them inside your house. Of course, what we should also talk about is weather stripping and sealing to make sure that our house is as weather tight as possible, which also makes it as insect proof as possible. But those on the outside of the house, we wish they would stay outside, but we'll have to deal with the ones that get in between now and next spring.
All right. And this is from Anna on Twitter. She says, how do I get rid of stinky devil's fungus mushrooms?
Less rainfall?
Well, basically, you can remove them, but you can't stop them from coming up. So The weather this spring and summer has been very favorable. It's been very wet, very damp. And so you cannot put anything on the ground that will stop them from coming up. So you just basically discard them when they do.
All right. And let's get back to the phone. Shirley is on the line in Webster City. Hi, Shirley.
Hi there. I had a snow crab planted about a month ago. I've been trying to water it about an inch once a week. I'm wondering if that is enough water and if I'm doing it often enough. It was almost, the leaves were pretty well gone by the time it was planted, and I thought I'd just water it as long as the ground was not frozen.
Right.
Is that the way to do it?
I would keep on watering if it doesn't rain until the ground does freeze.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say if you do it once every week or 10 days at this point, that should be sufficient.
Okay.
And I would just go out there if the hose would reach and turn on real slow.
Yes.
And let it run for maybe 5 or 10 minutes.
Uh-huh.
And then move it to the opposite side.
I see.
Let it run for 5 to 10 minutes.
Uh-huh.
Go back to the first side and do that again for another 5 to 10 minutes. Go back to the second side. You're done.
Okay. I've been running at about a half an hour at one time, all in the same place because I went and did something else. But I'll try moving it a little more.
Right. So you make sure that the whole soil ball basically is wet.
All right, Shirley. Thanks a lot. Next up, Mark in Marion. Hi, Mark. All right. For some reason, we seem to have trouble getting to Mark, but I do know what he wants to know. He wants to know how to get rid of Creeping Charlie.
Okay. Well, you can with a broadleaf herbicide if it's in the lawn. You want to make sure the herbicide contains either 2,4-D or triclopyr. That's T-R-I-C-L-O-P-Y-R. And you want to apply it twice. Now, typically, we do it sometime around early October and early November, but if you do it now, this week, and come back, let's say, in mid-November, that should work.
Okay. All right. Next up, Rick in Iowa City. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Rick. Morning.
Yeah, what's your question?
We're looking at a sad situation where we're going to have a 150-year-old white oak tree that is dead, taken off our property. And I know they'll be grinding up and hauling it away. I was wondering, can any of that be saved back and used as, like, wood mulch, or is it too new, dead, or just basically can I use that for wood mulch or not?
Oh, you can use that, definitely. I would have it chipped up, and I would probably put it in a pile. And what you want to do is to periodically kind of turn it over periodically. Okay, because if you don't, certain compounds can develop that can actually be harmful, that may harm some plants. So go ahead and turn that periodically, especially in the spring and summer, and you can definitely use it.
Mm-hmm. Would I have to wait until next fall to use it, or can I?
No, you can use it this fall if you want to. But if you have a big pile of it, make sure that you turn it. You know, if you can't use it all at once, make sure that you turn it periodically during the spring and summer.
The good news is, chipping is not going to spread any pathogens that were in the wood in a white oak tree, so you're in luck that way.
All right, Rick, thank you so much for your call, and we got this email from John, and this is for you, Donald. He says, why do the woolly bears cross the road? To attend family reunions and to see their mothers.
They're mothers. Ooh.
Right.
Okay.
I don't know if that solves your problem or not.
Yeah, I think I may keep that question open for a while longer.
All right. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Charity. Always a pleasure.
Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron, thank you so much for being here today.
You're welcome.
And we will be back again next Friday with Horticulture Day. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Claire Roth, Lindsay Moon, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We had technical assistance today from Jason Burns in Ames. You can send us email anytime. We love to hear from you, your thoughts about things you hear on the show, suggestions for things you'd like to hear. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa. Have a great weekend.